Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Joel Westheimer, and I'm the University Research Chair in Democracy and Education at the University of Ottawa here in Canada.
And Prof. Joel, it's great to see you after I don't know how many years when we've been in occasional communication on email, but we haven't actually sat down together for, I'm thinking, 25 years, maybe.
It's amazing, but I remember well our days as colleagues in the same institution.
Which we are both out of now.
Yes.
And Prof. Joel, I wanted to begin by asking you what's currently dynamizing, retarding, preoccupying, interesting you?
I am very preoccupied right now with the state of democracy around the world and democratic institutions. And specifically, since I'm in education, with diminishing commitments among young people to democratic institutions. So the percentage of young people who, for example, would like to live in a country ruled by a strong leader who didn't have to deal with interference from parliaments or Congress or the courts has skyrocketed. And that's true for all across the demographic, but in particular, young people have basically thrown up their hands with democracy. And in some ways, we can't really blame them for that because democracy has not delivered on many of the things that they find important. For example, climate change or housing, health insurance, things like that. And so there's a lot of disenchantment with democratic institutions. And this worries me because it goes alongside a growing kind of enamoring of autocratic leadership around the world, and I'll hasten to say that it's not just Trump. We're seeing it in countries around the world. Trump's a symptom, not a cause, although he certainly furthers the cause of autocratic leadership. So this is, I think, what keeps me up at night, Toby.
And you've mentioned the failure to deliver on certain promises. My next question was going to be to what you attribute this. And I guess you've given some answers, but are there other things? Or do you want to elaborate a bit on the point about housing and healthcare and climate?
Yeah, I think that there's a confluence of a number of phenomenon. And the biggest of which on my mind, I think, is the radical increase in economic inequality that we've seen in North America and around the world. And this is owing to a variety of neoliberal policies that have diminished the importance of relationships and community and increased the importance of a purely market approach to life in so many arenas. And the reason economic inequality is linked to democratic instability is the most obvious reason is money in politics. And that's especially true in the United States. But that's not only the only cause. The economic inequality leads to uncertainty and fear about livelihoods and about the ability to make ends meet. And that often makes people look for a strong leader a strong man leader who promises to fix it all, with no evidence, of course, that they can. But the attraction of that kind of leadership is seductive to people when life feels unstable. So economic inequality, a dominance of neoliberal market policies in so many arenas in life, and the failure of democracy to deliver for what young people and many of us want to see.
And somewhere in there's something about masculinity, I suspect, Prof,
yeah,
in that you mentioned the strong man, and that's what I had in mind too.
Yeah.
How does this operate? How does this function, do you think?
Yeah, I think that there's been some really good stuff written on the psychological aspects of autocracy and the preference for sort of a strong father figure. But we don't have to even go to, you know, to that level of psychology, although I think there's a lot to that, to know that people look for sort of a kind of arrogance in leadership. And the arrogance is this confidence, this misplaced confidence, that one person can fix the problems that the country faces or that the world faces. And that kind of arrogance is predominant, among males. Of course, everyone can throw out Margaret Thatcher, but, it's few and far between the leaders who are women who project that kind of misplaced confidence and arrogance. And so I think there is this predilection for a male leader, as a strong man and not a strong woman who can, who purports to be able to fix these problems and to, make people's lives more stable.
And Prof, you've spent much of your career in two countries, in particular the United States and Canada. I wondered if I could ask you to reflect on the tendencies you've just mentioned with reference to those two countries. You know, the fantasy that Canada is the kind of nice North American country where people are basically liberal and cuddly.
Exactly. So I think there's some truth, of course, to Canada being closer to a social democracy than the United States, especially now, although we're about to elect a rather conservative leader, Poilievre, who's a Trump wannabe. But there's the checks and balances have so far worked quite well in Canada with the parliamentary system. And there are greater commitments even among conservatives to certain aspects of social democracy. So healthcare for decades has been a rather untouchable political issue. Commitments to collective bargaining is much stronger here and to unions. There are commitments that are have been until recently unshakable. Now there's movements now to privatize aspects of healthcare because of disappointments with the way that healthcare is being delivered. But we always forget that those disappointments are within a system where 100% of people have healthcare as opposed to the United States. But the other thing is that the Canada is not in any way immune to the trends that go on in the United States. It's so much a bigger country and it's right next door. And so a lot of the bad trends that happen in the US, and this goes for education as well, but also economic trends and social trends, and political trends, I think of them as tending to seep across the border about 5 or 6 years later in a kinder, gentler form, as you're saying. But still some of them stick. And in fact, because I do speaking in both countries, I sometimes feel like one of those characters from a dystopian sci-fi novel who goes to the future and says, don't go there. Don't go there. I've seen what happens, and then comes back to, to warn people, what they've seen. And sometimes when I go to the US or think about US policies, I know that they're going to come across the border in some kind of form. And I like warning people, not to go there, although, it's not always received in that way.
And Canada, of course, was later to free itself of British and French imperialism than the United States. Does that play any part in this difference?
Well, I think yes, and for better and for worse, and it's interesting to have the perspective coming from the US. So, for better, there's a kind of radical tradition in the US that we shouldn't forget, that there's a kind of implicit critique of policies, there's a wariness of government in the good sense, not in the sense that we're seeing from conservatives, in the sense that government can't do anything, but in the sense of a wariness about government overreach in terms of autocracy and unfair rules. And there's a kind of implicit critique embedded in the U.S. psyche that I think is valuable. On the other hand, in Canada, we have far greater commitments to collective enterprises and to the good that government can do, and to the knowledge that government is essential to take on public projects. And those commitments, I think, are a little more impervious to conservative onslaughts on collective projects and on the role that government can play. We have the idea of kind of tax and spend government as an insult, I think doesn't take hold in Canada in the way that it does in the US, because in Canada, we see the role of government is to tax and, of course, spend. We pool money together to take on projects that we can't do alone or even in small communities. There's greater commitments to community centers, to community swimming pools, of course, to healthcare, as I mentioned, and to collective undertakings that government has a role in. And so that's a big difference that I see in the two countries. And even with recent conservative attacks on liberal institutions in Canada, a lot is sticks and is still untouchable by political rhetoric. So that's a big difference.
In the field of education, the United States is an enormously complex place to understand. And you're not only an educator, but you're also an educator of educators. And one of your fields of research, and we'll get into others later, but they're all related, is education. What are you seeing as the big trends in Canada and in the United States?
Well, here's a good example, Toby, of what I said is that policies that start in the U.S. Have a way of seeping across the border in a more gentle form. One of the things that we've seen in the U.S. in the last few decades, and it's starting to wane now, but for decades it grew and was incredibly damaging to education. Is the trend to standardize everything and to make testing dominant in education reform. And I'm not against all forms of standardized testing, but this language of standardization and accountability is really problematic for educational institutions. There's nothing wrong with the word standards, of course, or accountability. I've never met a teacher who doesn't have standards or who doesn't feel accountable. They're accountable to the students they teach, to the parents, to the principal, to their communities, and to the nation and to the world. The problem isn't with the word standards. It's with the word standardization, because standardization literally means making everything the same. Now, there's places where we like standardization. If I go into a McDonald's in downtown Toronto and I order a quarter pounder with cheese, I want that McDonald's to give me the same quarter pounder with cheese as the one that I had in some rural town in northern Quebec or in Illinois or in Paris. Of course, I would never go to a McDonald's in Paris, but people do. We want standardization in McDonald's, but schools are not McDonald's, and we don't want every teacher doing the same thing at the same time, because what brings life to classrooms is the individual passions and interests of teachers locally and students locally, their experiences, their passions, their interests, and their commitments. You know, I speak a lot around the world, and one of the things I love doing is asking people about their favorite teacher. And I'll tell you that never once have I gotten the answer, you know, I liked Mr. Miller, and the reason I liked Mr. Miller is because he did everything exactly the same as every other teacher in the country, right? Nobody says that. The teachers we remember are the ones who turned their classroom into a magical place. They made it a jungle, or the math teacher who took their class down to the corner where a building was being constructed and did geometry based on the angles of this building going up. Those are the teachers that we remember, and the ones who build on the experiences and interests of students in their classes. And so standardization has been a huge problem for education, because it's put a straitjacket around teachers who want to build on their local interests and on local experiences. It's also standardized testing has become the school reform tail that's wagged the school reform dog, right? It's just become so dominant that it drives the curriculum, because what gets tested gets taught, and this myopic obsession with standardized testing, and also usually in only two subject areas, right? In math and literacy, and to the exclusion of other subject areas. And so in many schools and many school districts, we see standardized testing making certain subjects go away or be put on the back burner, including history and science and even and language art, well, language arts to the kind that doesn't feed into success on the standardized tests. And even things like recess and the arts, we see pushed to the back burner. And so this has been a huge problem for decades in education, and I would love to see that kind of straitjacket on teachers around the narrowing of the curriculum removed and eased, lessened in North America and around the world.
I have great anxiety about the testing regimes, Prof. I'm not an expert on this, unlike you, but I very much appreciate your mentioning it because it takes the joy out of learning, it seems to me. And in particular, I can remember from my own childhood, but it's much worse now, being told that at age X, in my case, it was 15 or 16, what happens this week or the end of this year will determine the rest of your life. Putting the fear of name your deity, as it were, into me and others, I think. And now that's happening earlier and earlier and more often. Your life's future is determined now by this and that and the other. And where is the joy in that of the kind that you were mentioning? I mean, are these ill-founded amateur worries or are they real?
No, these are very, very real, and I think joy is a wonderful word to attach to education, and in mainstream school reform, it hasn't been used in a long, long time. The joy of learning, the love of learning, and standardized testing has a way of sapping students' and teachers' energy for that kind of intrinsic joy that we see in the most authentic of lessons. And as you point out, in the US at least, these tests are not just tests of systems, but high stakes tests for individual teachers and individual students. And that makes them even more powerful in this way of sapping the joy out of learning. And high stakes testing meaning that they have significance and impact on teachers. We even have districts where there's what's called merit pay, where teachers get extra money or less money based on their students' performance. And of course, how many variables go into their students' performance, not the least of which is, as I mentioned before, economic inequality and the conditions under which these students are growing up. So it's standardized testing, you're right to point out, has been very damaging for a more authentic and joyful kind of education. And I'll say that again, going back to the difference between Canada and the US, is Canada has experienced this onslaught of standardized testing, but less high stakes testing. So more, it still drives the curriculum, but it's been more implemented in a way that impacts systems rather than individual teachers or students, but it's still damaging, and it's still been very bad for the kind of education that so many educators go into teaching to do, and it's pushed many teachers out of teaching. So we have an epidemic of teachers leaving the profession within the first 5 years that they start teaching. And those are some of the best teachers who leave because they have other options and they're tired of being restricted in the ways that they teach. And I will say, it's not that it's not that there we we shouldn't have general frameworks for what should be taught in schools. Those can be shared in common across schools in a state or a country or a province. It's just that when obsession with standards and standardization and testing drives the curriculum and narrows the curriculum, that's when we veer into troublesome territory.
Britain's Office for Standards in Education, Children's Services and Skills, Ofsted, has as its slogan, I'm reading this from its website now, raising standards, improving lives. As you may know, Prof. Joel, a leading headmistress or principal committed suicide not long ago after Ofsted, after, spending 5 minutes observing things and looking at standards, all of this in scare quotes, gave her school a poor rating. And although that's one instance, this has led to a huge debate in Britain about what the hell these people at Ofsted are doing, what they know, and most of all, the psychological impact it's having on people who actually teach and learn. And I think something good will eventually come of that, but it really horrifies me. And so, related to that, I wanted to ask you about, you mentioned that you give talks internationally, your impact locally, nationally, internationally, because in addition to publishing books and articles by the bucketful, you are also somebody who has a significant public profile in Canadian media, for example, but elsewhere too. Could you talk to us a little bit about that, what you try to get across there, and what the reaction's been from the public to a message that is obviously close to my heart?
That's a great question, and I love talking about that. Let me just say something about your previous comment about Ofsted, because every country has a version of that. Here in Ontario, because education is provincial, we have something called EQAO, which stands for the Educational Quality Accountability Office. If that doesn't sound Orwellian, as so many of these do, I don't know what does. Kids call it evil questions attacking Ontario, EQAO. But these kinds of institutions, they're not filled with bad people or anything. People aren't trying. They don't have in mind to destroy the education system, although there are people who do, and that's more the privatization trend. But I know some good people who work for these institutions, but it's really a misplaced way of trying to improve the system, and as you said, is one of the slogans, improve lives, because I think it does the opposite. And so that's really the case. So let me move to what you said, this kind of public-facing work. I think because of many of the things that we're talking about, I often feel that teachers and other educators now have a dual role. One is public education, teaching and learning, but the other is educating the public. And that means we have to teach people who are not involved in schools, what schooling is about and what teachers require to be able to do their jobs well. Because I think something that's often forgotten, in public discussion is that teachers' teaching conditions are students' learning conditions, right? The way we treat teachers impacts the way they're able to deliver a rich education to students. And so I've tried as much as I can to talk to not just educators and academics in education, but also to the general public. And I find it very rewarding because there's a real thirst for knowledge about what goes on in schools. People start with the assumption that they know exactly what goes on in schools because we've all been in schools so much of our lives. Everyone's been in school for 12 or 16 or 20 or more years. And that gives us the sense that we know what schooling is like from all perspectives. But of course, we only know it from the student perspective, and we have very little understanding of what drives schools behind the scenes, what teachers' working conditions are, what curricular demands are on schools, how standards and accountability drive school reform. People don't know about those things. And so I feel my work in that area, talking to the public, and not just teachers and academics, is it's important to me because I feel like fostering that dialogue increases people's knowledge of what goes on in schools, and therefore I hope increases their commitments to what goes on in schools. And so it's been very rewarding for me in that sense.
Related to that is a question I have about parental empowerment. a slogan or a concept that is used a lot in the United States
Yeah.
that is trying to get rid of teacher authority and autonomy and empower incredibly reactionary views on the part of families in many, many cases. What's your take on that? Because at some level, I'm all in favor of parental empowerment. We want our children to be happy at school and not awful, and we want to participate to the extent feasible in that process.
Yeah. Parental empowerment is probably one of our best examples, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, because it's a broader cultural phenomenon, which is the extreme right wing has been able and been very successful at co-opting progressive language, right? And so parental empowerment used to mean that we want parents involved in their child's education, not in dictating to teachers what they should teach and how they should teach it, but to be involved and engaged in the life of the school and the educational life of their children. But now parental empowerment has been hijacked, those terms, and it's been hijacked by a group of people, a relatively small group of people, but growing, who want to censor books, for example, and who want to make model learning in the image of career training and nothing else. They want to sap away the social functions of learning. And that's one of our biggest problems, I think. Another trend in society that we could talk about is the move away from schools as instruments of social progress in society, socializing students in participating in democratic life, in engaging with their communities and learning, finding the joy in what they want to do and what they want to learn, and move towards the idea of schools at all levels. I mean, starting at kindergarten, making them job training institutions. And in a booklet crossed my desk the other day, called Job Training Skills for Kindergarteners. I mean, can you imagine? As if we know, first of all, what kind of careers kindergartners are going to be in 15 or 20 years. But more to the point of what I'm trying to argue is that that's not even the right goals for education. In fact, this has been a fantastically successful campaign by corporate America in the United States and corporations around the world to download what used to be their responsibilities in training for the jobs that they do while paying workers, training for the jobs they needed. They've been spectacularly successful and cynical in downloading that training that they used to have to spend money on schools and on other institutions in society. Schools shouldn't be about job training. That's what comes later when you're in the job that you're doing. Of course, they should prepare students for the work world in part by literacy skills and mathematics skills and critical thinking skills and all these others, but they should not be doing the specific job training that businesses used to do at their own expense. And again, this kind of school reform, which has spread around the world in its bad sense, has helped to advance that as well. Pasi Sahlberg, an educator who writes about Finnish education because Finland has resisted this onslaught of standardized testing and accountability to a large extent. He talks about GERM, which he coined as an acronym. It's the Global Education Reform Movement. And he talks about how it starts in one school district and infects the ones around it. And then those infect others in other countries. And it's true, until now, we have this dominant language of school reform that is encompasses many of these bad things that we're talking about. But circling back to this idea of parental empowerment, it's been weaponized as a tool to restrict meaningful learning and to restrict the kind of education that you and I and many of your listeners might find the rich kind of education that we really value. And takes away the idea of many of the skills, attitudes, and knowledge that are associated with education in a democratic society.
And speaking of democratic societies, Prof, one of the themes of your books and articles is citizenship. One of your books is called something like "What Kind of Citizenship?" I think.
Yeah, what kind of citizen? That's right.
What kind of citizen?
Yeah, what kind of citizen educating our children for the common good? So that gives you a sense of where I'm coming from.
So, could you explain to us what a citizen is and what a citizen needs to know? This sounds like an 80s US sort of popular, E.D. Hirsch book, I realize.
Yeah. So let's get two things out of the way. First, I want to tell you what I don't mean by citizenship. The first is I'm not talking here about the legal definition of citizen. So when I talk about citizen, I want to use the definition of members of a community. You're a citizen of that community. So I'm not talking about excluding people who haven't gotten citizenship yet or who are denied legal citizenship, legal membership in a country, or denied the rights associated with that. I'm talking about members of a community and specifically democratic community because of the special requirements of citizenship in a democracy. And secondly, the other thing to get out of the way is I don't mean the sort of death by civics in civics education that you and I might have experienced in school, the civics that's focused on just facts, you know, how a bill becomes a law or how old you have to be president, you know, things like these disconnected facts that don't add up to meaningful understandings of civic engagement. What I do mean by citizenship, and I'll talk a little bit about the different kinds of citizen, if that's okay. But what I do mean is the ways that young people are taught to engage or not engage in their communities and in democratic life. And that is very important for the furthering of democracy. And in fact, when we think about, we talked about, you know, a little bit about what schools are for, and I mentioned that I don't think that they're primarily for job training, even though they are giving people the skills they might need later to find effective work. But they're primarily about advancing society in all kinds of ways that are meaningful to the broader public. People, for example, who say, you know, why should I pay for public education if I don't have kids or my kids are done with school? Why should I contribute? And the answer to that is because we don't only have an interest in our children being educated, most people have an interest and want to live in an educated society, because otherwise we get big problems that affect all of us, not just parents and not just people adjacent to the children. We want an educated society. We want to live in an educated society. So let me talk about citizenship, and since the book is called What Kind of Citizen, I'll just tell you a little bit in a brief way about the kinds of citizenship that colleagues and I did work in to research and what kind of citizenship is represented in educational programs. Is that okay if I talk a little bit about that?
Beautiful. Go ahead, sir.
Okay. So we looked at a number of programs, initially just 10 programs in the United States. And this is my colleague Joe Kahn, who's at University of California, Riverside. And we looked at 10 colleagues, many, 10 programs many years ago. That ain't claimed to teach democratic citizenship, you know, that aimed to engage students in a kind of participation and political engagement that would teach them the skills and the attitudes they needed to participate as effective citizens in a democracy. And we wanted to know the question we were asking is, what kind of citizenship do these programs advance? So, for example, if you and I went out into the street and asked 100 people, do you think schools should teach good citizenship? We'd get a lot of head nodding agreement. You know, yeah, of course schools should teach good citizenship. But if we Can I just ask you one other question? What exactly do you mean by good citizenship, and what should schools do to teach that, right? That's when we get a lot of disagreement and a lot of multiplicity of views about what good citizenship is. So we were interested in not just whether these programs teach good citizenship, but in how and why and what kind of vision of the good citizen they embraced. And what we found is there were three broad visions of the good citizen that most of these programs reflected, because you know how professors love to put things in boxes. It doesn't mean that every program fit neatly into one of these boxes, but it gives us a helpful way to talk about different visions of good citizenship. And I'll just quickly tell you about those three visions. We called the first one the personally responsible citizen, the second one the participatory citizen, as in participation, and the third the social justice oriented citizen. So the first one were programs that emphasized a vision of citizenship that revolved around a kind of being a good person. So, don't litter. Don't do drugs, pay your taxes, show up to work or school on time, dress nicely, be nice to other people, help an old person across the street, or give blood when blood is needed. Things like that. Someone who would make a good neighbor, the kind of people you'd want to live next to, the kind of people you want around you. And that was the personally responsible kind of citizen, because they're personally responsible. They're individually responsible for their actions. And a vast majority of school-based programs teach this version of the good citizen, right? They want kids to be nice and to be responsible and to be decent citizens to other people. But another kind of vision of a good citizen that was represented by a good number of programs in schools was this participatory vision of a good citizen. And those were programs that wanted to emphasize not just being a good person, but also working with others to engage in collective projects for the common good, right? They wanted people to know how government works, know how to get things done, and help organize in their community to get things done that were good for their communities. So, for example, if the participatory citizen were organizing a food drive, the personally responsible citizen would be donating cans of food because they're good people, right? But remember, I said there were three visions, and the last vision of the good citizen we called the social justice-oriented citizen. And these were programs that specifically asked students to look at the root causes of problems in society. So they might, and how to improve these problems, right? How to ameliorate them. So these programs might, for example, might teach the history of social movements and how social change actually happens. They might teach students about power relationships in society and what obstacles there are to change. So, for example, that example I gave before, if the participatory citizens are organizing a food drive, the personally responsible citizens are donating cans of food, the social justice-oriented citizens might be asking, how come in a rich country, perhaps one of the richest countries in the world, people are hungry? Right? And what can we do about it? They want to get at these root causes of problems. And these programs, there's lots of teachers who convey some of those values, but they're far less represented in institutional approaches to civic education. So the most common programs were personally responsible citizens. The next ones were participatory citizens, and the least commonly represented are programs that specifically aim at a social justice-oriented kind of citizenship.
So, respectively, the first of these would be Reaganism.
Yes.
Second would be Republicanism with a lowercase r.
Yes.
And the third would be social movements and people like Carlito Marx. a loss.
Exactly. Looking at power relationships in that sense.
Yeah.
And you know what's interesting, Toby? If we think about what democracy requires, then we can say that that first kind of citizenship, the personal responsibility, might be about being a good citizen, but it has absolutely nothing to do with being a democratic citizen. Here's a thought experiment I like to think about. If you were transported from where we are doing this podcast, if your listeners were transported suddenly, and dropped in a classroom somewhere around the world, and let's say they watch a lesson unfold for half an hour. And since it's a thought experiment, let's pretend that they can't tell where they are based on the language being spoken or the, dress that people are wearing. My question is, would we be able to tell whether we had landed in a classroom in a totalitarian country or an autocracy, or whether we had landed in a classroom in a democratic country? And the reason I like this thought experiment is because many of us would like to believe, like, of course we could tell the lessons in an Australian classroom or a British classroom or an American classroom would look nothing like the classrooms in a totalitarian dictatorship or a religious theocracy or a country ruled by a military junta. But when you think about it, a lot of the lessons might be very similar in those countries, wouldn't they? I mean, teaching fractions or addition or subtraction, teaching how to balance an equation in chemistry, teaching the composition of soil, or the mineral composition or the life cycle of a glowworm, right? Teaching how to read. All of these things might be similar in different countries around the world. And so this raises a bigger question for me, and the real question I want to get at, which is, if many of these lessons are similar, then what exactly should be, if anything, different in classrooms in democratic countries than classrooms in a dictatorship? And I think we have an answer to this, several answers, because democracies require different things of their citizens than a totalitarian dictatorship, even a benevolent dictatorship, right? Let's not talk about a corrupt dictatorship, but even one where the leader has the best interests of the people in mind. Even in that dictatorship, the edicts are going to be handed down from on high, right? One person or a group of people is going to say how we should all live, and what laws we should pass and what laws we should abide by. But a democracy requires much more of their citizens. A democracy requires that citizens participate in big questions like how we should live, right? And how we should live is a very radical question because it implies that we have choices and that those choices have consequences and that we are all engaged in helping determine how we should live. Democracies require that citizens participate not just by voting, that's the sort of weakest form, right? But also by engaging in community life in a way that helps determine what we believe in and what we want to fight for. So we need to deal. So what are two characteristics of education for democracy? Here's just two examples. One is the idea that we need students and young people and older people who ask difficult questions about the world around them, right? We need to know that there are problems in the world and that people have to be engaged in helping to solve those problems because there's no leader or group of leaders who are going to solve all those problems without engagement from the community. And the second is that students need to deal with multiple perspectives. They need to know that well-meaning, thoughtful adults differ in important matters of social concern, and that it's their job to understand those multiple perspectives and make decisions about what they believe in and what values they hold and what they want to fight for. Because that is, and especially dissent is so important in a democratic society. It's the engine of progress in the democratic society. It's how we move forward. So those are just two examples. I think there are many more that we could come up with of what democracies require and why, therefore, schools in a democracy should do something, at least many things different than schools in a totalitarian dictatorship.
Prof, I'd like to ask you one more question, if I may, and
Yeah.
then throw to you to conclude things with anything you'd like to add to what you've said. Might be going over terrain we've covered, or it might be something entirely new. So my last question is to ask you how you learn about education in your research. What do you do?
Yeah, that's a nice question. In educational research, there are a number of approaches, and there's quantitative approaches to education. We can study broad statistics. We can implement large-scale surveys to get a sense of representative samples of what's going on in schools across, within a state or a province, or across states or provinces, or across countries. We can compare. That's the bird's eye view of what's going on. But I often find that that is okay for answering certain questions, but it's not enough for getting at some of the deeper questions we want to answer in educational research. And for that, you need to be inside schools. You need to observe lessons that are going on. You need to conduct interviews with teachers and students and school administrators. Those kind of studies get at the richness of what happens in schools. Another weakness of large-scale surveys, although they're very good at capturing big trends, they tell us a lot about trends across, but we don't always know why people are answering surveys the way they're answering, right? We sometimes get surprised that people interpret a question in a way that's different than we intended it when we made the survey. And qualitative approaches to research allow us to ask people follow-ups, to ask them why they answered questions in the way they did, how they're thinking about those questions. And so some of the most powerful research approaches are what's called mixed methods, where we do large-scale surveys and quantitative approaches, and we mix them with follow-up qualitative research, or at the same time, qualitative research to better understand why people are answering the way they are.
Thanks very much, Prof. And to conclude, wondering if there are things we haven't discussed that you'd like to mention, or things you want to add to what we have mentioned.
Well, I'll say one other broad thing that I think is important from a cultural studies perspective. I think that culturally, we have done something weird with the notion of politics. And I mean politics with a small p, because we've made politics a bad word. If I say, "Oh, Toby, you're just being political," it's like I've insulted you, right? Isn't it? It's like I've called you a mudslinging political candidate running for office and only interested in your own power. But as you know, politics has a much more noble history, and it has a cultural history and a political history. There's a famous book by a Canadian, actually, Bernard Crick, called "In Defense of Politics." And in it, he says politics is the way that we in a democratic society come together to work out our differences and move forward towards policy. And when I think about education, I think of the need to bring that kind of notion of politics in, right? The kind where we teach students to engage with each other around political ideas and political goals. And we don't have enough of that in school. We need to recapture that good version of the term politics. That's what's important in a democratic society.
Beautifully put. Thanks so much, Joel. In the more than a quarter of a century I've been reading your work, I always gain much therefrom. And it's been fantastic learning from you live today. Greatly appreciated.
My pleasure, Toby. This was a great, great discussion, and let's have more of them.